There are ways you can sell on short form that actually work. I learned this from all the bloggers, like all the cooking bloggers and the mommy bloggers. They'll post a recipe, like a video recipe, crispy baked potatoes or something like that. And what they'll do is they'll use ManyChat. And if you comment a specific word, let's say crispy, it will read that and it will auto send in an Instagram compliant way a button. And that button will be a link to whatever you want. It removes like 5 to 7 steps of friction from converting from social, because Instagram would be like, read the caption, click on the person's profile, click on their bio, which is a link in bio, scroll around on all those buttons to find the thing, click on that. So it just takes it to one step, click on your DM, click that link. And I think on TikTok and Instagram, probably we've sold like 1,000 copies just from doing that.
How did Spotlight Oral Care get 6 million views and over $30,000 in earned media value on TikTok? How did Plant People drive a 50% decrease in cost per add to cart and over a 30% increase in ROAS? To go big like these brands, you gotta think small and work with mini social micro influencers to create authentic UGC for your brand. Tired of hunting down and DMing creators on social, negotiating back and forth, only to have their one-off post flop and not impact your sales? Leave it to MiniSocial to handle all the nitty-gritty of booking the right creators for your brand, delivering top-quality content you can use across your ads and organic social media. Ready to try them out for yourself? Get 15% off your first project when you start in Q2. To claim your D2C listener discount, just go to dtc.minisocial.com.
Plant Daddy, welcome to the D2C podcast. This is another great introduction from Carly Craig. Into my orbit here. I've been following you on Twitter. You're a great personality there. Welcome to the D2C podcast.
Hey man, thank you so much. Happy that we finally got to do this.
Walk us through the Plant Daddy story. To talk, let's hear about epic gardening and your hero's journey in this space.
Oh man, the Plant Daddy story. I feel like I've shared it so many times. The abridged version is went to college, business economics accounting. Didn't really love accounting. Didn't mind it. Didn't love it. Was playing online poker to pay for that degree somewhat successfully. I mean, I made enough to pay for school and then some, which is pretty good. But it also instilled in me this sort of aversion to like the traditional corporate career. And so when I came out of school, I didn't get a job in accounting on purpose. But I also didn't know what else to do. So kind of floundered around for a little bit, got very addicted to video games once I quit poker, and then tried a bunch of different businesses. Like I was building websites on WordPress. I was then marketing those websites for local businesses. And everything was doing okay. Like I could pay my bills. I was doing fine. But it wasn't breaking through in the way that I was like hoping that it would. So I ended up mentoring at this company called Book in a Box, which was a second employee there. It's called Scribe Media now. Okay. And they've since launched a couple of New York Times bestsellers. They did David Goggins' book, Can't Hurt Me, wow, et cetera. So learned a lot on how businesses grow there and then
was
left.
Self-publishing? Was it like a self-publishing place?
It's self-publishing, but I guess I would call it like a bit of a hybrid self-pub, because in Goggins' case, I believe, you know, you they went a little above and beyond. Like you could get a distribution deal, but you could own all the rights to the book yourself. So it's a bit of a hybrid, but regardless, yeah, self-pub primarily. But anyways, so left that company after about 15, 18 months or so, and then went full-time on Epic when it was making like $400 or $500 a month as a blog. And grew that to about $2,000 or $3,000 a month in revenue, which is not a lot, but it paid for the bills.
Ad-supported or
just all
things?
Ads. Yeah, yeah, it was all ads on the blog and affiliate, you know, Amazon commissions or something. That was the sophistication level we were at back then. And then slowly over the next few years, this was like 2016, 2019 or so, launched different, you know, media formats. So video, podcast, all that kind of stuff. And then in 2019, the D2C comes into play when I started offering a raised bed product that I knew would do well because my audience was asking for it. And so, you know, the demand validation side was very easy if you have an audience. And so I just did a distribution deal with the suppliers out of Australia and brought the product in, and just the jankiest Shopify site you could imagine. You know, I just put my face on. I said, like, I have the beds and there's a little PDP, you know? And so, you know, that did really well to my surprise. Like bought a 20-foot container, sold it out on the water, used that money, bought another 20-foot, sold it out on the water. And I was like, oh, okay. Like there's a real business behind this media side of the gardening business, you know?
And what size kind of was the media business when you launched that hero product?
So 2019, the media business did $250,000 in revenue. Which,
and how many subs?
Oh man, back then I would say I had probably hit 100,000 on YouTube, but not too much higher than that. And then the blog, really difficult to say, but not a crazy amount of traffic, but certainly respectable, like 300, 400,000 visits a month, something like that.
And a perfect product integration, because you're featuring in all your videos, you're probably featuring these raised beds as well, right? It's what you use.
Yeah, I mean, I'd gotten, because when you're a creator, right? I mean, brands obviously want to do a deal with you, or they want to send you product. And so if you think really in one sense, if you put on a full business hat of what that content is functioning as, it's functioning as demand validation for products that you put in it. And so if someone goes, what is that bed? What is that bed? What is it? And you go, maybe I'll just offer it to the people that are asking. Like, you don't have to invent something new in that case. And so I went, the very easy route of just buying and distributing a product that didn't exist in America. Obviously, now we've sort of put that product on the map and there's five competitors that are sort of copying everything, but kind of the nature of the game.
Cool. Okay. So you've got the product market fit. Your linear commerce it was funny. Before I did D2C, I did a newsletter for boomers called Boundless Boomer, and we were trying to sell CBD off the back end of it. It didn't really work because we didn't really have a product that really resonated with people, as opposed to you, which were making these videos that I'm sure you learned very early on. Like how it's funny. I was just watching your video from your page. You talked about wanting to get back to making classic epic videos. Just like what's a classic Plant Daddy video on the Epic Gardening channel on YouTube?
Yeah, I mean, the classics would be a little bit of frill, but mostly educational. So like, how to grow rosemary. How do you grow rosemary in a container if you're a beginner? How do you do it? I mean, if you don't know how plants grow, you don't know how to grow rosemary. And so I would dress the title up a little bit, of course. You want someone to click and nice, beautiful thumbnail. And I'd structure the information in a very pleasing way. But at its core, it is a guide on how to grow a plant, and I think as the years go on, we're 600-700 videos deep on that channel, secondary channel, a couple hundred, many, many short forums, many thousands of podcasts. So it's like there is a level of stretching for a topic sometimes. And I kind of just want to go back to like, have I ever done a video on how to grow carrots? Not really. Yeah. So why don't I just do that? Just keep it simple again.
Very cool. Okay, so describe the growth. Like once you've got this product, that you've got this great product market fit, how did you hit the gas on it to the level that you're at now with, 2.2 million subs and 20-30 employees?
Frankly, the first year, 2019, I think I bought five shipping containers from my supplier, and they were all 20 foots. So they weren't that full 40-foot high cube. So the next step, of course, is you start ordering the 40 foots because you get more in per your overall freight cost per container. And so you start optimizing that. I then decided to buy a warehouse instead of use a 3PL, which at the time I thought was a pretty smart decision because you get to build equity in the building while you are your own tenant, and you sort of get this like real estate holding company thing going, and you can kind of live that like personal holdco model, as people like to talk about on the internet sometimes. And the idea though was I was looking at my 3PL fees and I was like, dude, I'm spending 20, 30 grand a month just on these pick and packs and storage. Why don't I just spend half that on the mortgage and an extra 5K on the labor or something like that? And the economic structure is obviously way better. Turns out that actually was true, but it added a lot of complexity because of course you're then doing it yourself. And if you think about what your superpower is, it's probably not picking and packing boxes, unless you're, Daddy Bezos or someone on that level. And so I ended up selling that warehouse mostly because we're shutting it down and we're moving our fulfillment to Colorado. We acquired a seed company in 2022 and they had a facility in Colorado. So we said, okay, well, let's consolidate our operations there. It's better for shipping. And shut that warehouse down, sold it. Fortunately, it was like great timing, was able to do well in the sale. But, just interesting learning lessons, I guess, as you go from content into direct-to-consumer e-com. Scale up-wise, though, I mean, frankly, going into 2020, 2021, you're going into a pandemic, right? Which we couldn't have foreseen, but I was very fortunate to have the business up and running before that, so I could at least service the demand that I could service. If I had to spin the e-com business up in that year, basically would not have been happening. So I got really lucky there, and it was crazy. Like, there was no ads required. I mean, it was $0 on paid ads up until 2022, and we ended 2021 with like 7.3 million in revenue. So that's no paid ad spend at all, which is just, for a YouTuber, I haven't seen someone hit a number quite like that on a small team. But again, it was like an outlier of a year, right? So it's crazy.
Everyone wanted to enrich their, you know, there's so many people that went back to things like gardening when they, you know, when the rest of the world became chaotic as well. Right. And you're just putting something good into the world too, which is really cool.
Well, it's hard to root against someone who wants to grow plants, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
So it's a very wholesome activity. We try to spice it up here and there, the whole plant daddy thing or whatever, you know, but, I mean, back then I couldn't even get enough product. So my problem was not how to scale on the sense of like generating the demand. It was just, how do I get it into your garden? So back then we used to say, hey, I just ordered, you know, 5 more containers. They're coming in probably 90 days, but I'm not even sure of that because the ports were all crazy. So if you want them, just order them and I'll send them to you basically when I get them. But I am not exactly sure when that will be, you know? So that was the sales model back in those days.
And that's a video. That's a video and a blog post essentially in your two places?
No, I mean, I'd send an email out to the list, or I would do like a little swipe up on Instagram, or I might do it on YouTube. You know, I'd pepper it into content here and there. But the content traditionally, I try to keep servicing the mission. The mission is teach the world to grow. So I try to keep the content about how do I make you a better gardener, you know? And the hope is that you like the info and the info works for you and you do become a better gardener, and then you trust us and you want to buy the things that we recommend because we're gardeners, you know? We sell sometimes through the content. We try to save it for like special occasions, big launches, big sales. We don't try to like pepper in every little new ad to our assortment into the content.
I want to get into the product expansion, the seed company, but a bit more on the media company that you've kind of built. How do you think now at this point in 2024 about content production and the level, like how much content are you producing at this point to kind of service and grow this audience?
We're producing a lot. I mean, we produce, so we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 YouTube channels, I think now, 6, I guess, but obviously they're not all in production at the same cadence. We have a daily podcast or 5 times a week podcast. We have a blog, probably put out 100, 120 articles a month on the blog. So it's a lot. I mean, we know content really well, and we know it in pretty much every media format to some degree. Some we're better at, some we're worse at, but we're in every media format and we're more or less the dominant gardening company on those platforms. So we know that really well. And the problem though now is like, you're a direct-to-consumer brand and you also own a seed company that has a wholesale presence. And so the business is being driven in many other ways besides the content, right? And so we do spend on paid now, and we have to figure out how to better optimize that. We should have a more performant paid strategy than the average gardening brand because we have the audience. And so how do you leverage that? How do you leverage your content experience and improve your wholesale? Because if you can get feet indoors at local nurseries, which are pretty much the customers we support, not the big box, then they should want to carry your products, you know? And so the goal now is figuring out how to translate this advantage we've built in content into the world of the commercial side of the business.
Where it might not traditionally have the same benefits, but at the same time, you could carpet bomb all the, you know, geo-target your content to all the nursery people, right? Like, or you I'm could, sure a lot yeah. of them will see it anyway, right? Like
in, well, we're in their feeds. Like the thing about, it's both a big and small industry, right? Like if you're a passionate gardener and you work in a nursery, you pretty much know who Epic is to some degree, right? You might think my name is Eric, or you might think my name is that guy or whatever, but you've seen our content and you've seen some of our other creators' content. And so, and we're like, I'm a gardener. I love to garden. I have like 50 fruit trees in my backyard, all this stuff. So I know what I'm talking about. Not that I'm an expert. I never say I'm an expert, but I'm very passionate about it. So I'm trying to be as accurate as I can in what I put out there. And that, I think that's appreciated by the industry of passionate growers. And so you get a level of trust with those customers. They're like, oh yeah, we can include your video in our newsletter because we know it's correct, right? Versus like some, you know, random viral hack person.
Yeah. I talk about this on the podcast all the time, but it's what Pilot House and D2C have done in a lot of ways, where a huge chunk of the business comes to Pilot House being like, I'm ready to work with you because I've watched your content for 3 months or whatever. Right. So it's just a really great fit. I was a gardening questioner. What's the most rewarding plant to grow? What's your favorite plant to grow?
For me?
Yeah.
I would say it does change kind of every year. Cause if I've grown one before, it's less rewarding the second year, right? Diminishing returns or hedonic adaptation, whatever you want to call it. But The first time I grew a dragon fruit from scratch was really fun, really enjoyable. It's like a fascinating plant for the fact of how fast it blooms. It blooms for one night and then it closes in a night.
And you can see it almost going.
You can literally see it. In 10 minutes, you can see the change. So that was super fun. I mean, growing any crop I've grown for the first time, my own garlic, my own potatoes, my own oranges, you know, any of that stuff is really rewarding.
Is homegrown dragon fruit better tasting than store-bought dragon fruit? Is it like sweeter?
It is
because it's the most beautiful looking fruit in the world, but it's like every time I get it, I'm like disappointed unless I'm in a tropical location.
People say it tastes like a bland kiwi if they buy it at the store, and it's expensive. So so some fruits ripen off the plant and some do not. Dragon fruit is a plant that does not ripen off the plant. And so to transport it, you have to pick it unripe and you can't force ripen it. So it de facto, if you buy it from a store, is semi unripe. So you've never had a fresh ripe dragon fruit unless you've had one harvested by yourself. Or
and watched it bloom overnight as even you get that added benefit. Ideally.
Yeah.
That's sweet. Okay, let's talk about the seed company then. So you had a great success with the raised beds and your audience. Mm-hmm. So talk about that acquisition. How did you find the company to acquire?
Well, I've always known, the company's called Botanical Interests. I've always known them. It was the first seed pack I ever grew at the nursery. Beautiful illustrations on the packets, white packets. If you've ever been in a nursery, you know the ones I'm talking about. And so we were looking, when I had raised some money for the business in the end of 2021, part of that logic was, well, we can speed up our commercial side because we're slow there. I mean, it's the second thing I launched the content first. And so the logic was there must be something complementary that we can acquire and bring in and really transform or hope to transform. So the idea was we looked at a nursery, like a tree nursery to sell fruit trees. We looked at a million different things. And then Botanical Interests actually sort of was on the market. Like the founders wanted to retire, basically, an ex-married couple that founded the company. And so when we flew out there, I mean, the business logic is really clear. You have seeds, which is one of the few things that gardeners not only have to, but love to buy every year. You know, we all love shopping for our next variety. We want to see what the next cucumber is, the next tomato. We love when the catalog hits the doorstep. And so, you know, for that reason alone, the recurring commerce revenue was super attractive. The brand is bar none one of the best in the space. And I can say that as a gardener. And then just the fact that it was up for sale was interesting enough to throw our hat in, you know? And so I went out and met them and I think, there was a process, but we were fortunate that they chose us.
There's three overlapping like Venn diagrams of quality with this, right? Like anytime a marketer is buying a legacy business, there's the huge delta that they can improve the marketing. They can imply.
Sure.
And then you also have this built-in audience that's probably already familiar with the brand, but could maybe start buying through you.
Yeah.
What other synergies have you been able to add to it since taking it on?
Well, so you're right. Like I did a video called How Does a Seed Company Work? And it was a tour with me and the founders. And at the end, they like gave me the keys, you know? And so that was our announcement and people were literally mind blown. They were like, I can't believe this. This is my favorite, you know, YouTube channel. This is also my favorite seed company. Like tons of people would say like, I was about to place my order at another company. I'm literally only shopping here now, you know? So like shows you the power of the audience connection and like to have that support from our audience is just so cool. There were a ton of different like advantages we saw because this is a company that's traditionally a wholesale business. They sell to mostly retailers around the country, like 4,000 plus stores. And so you obviously the online opportunity, right? In a way that's not channel competitive to our beloved wholesalers, right? You don't want to undercut your wholesalers on the internet. Like that's not a good form. And so it's just expanding and blowing up the online presence of the brand, obviously spinning content up for that brand since we know how to do that well. The idea that we stock and sell at this point in the history of the company, by the time we owned Botanical, we had been developing our own products, not just distributing. And so saying, well, we've sold hundreds of thousands of these on the internet. Why wouldn't our wholesalers want to carry this product? So product line expansion through the nurseries, which is starting to work right now this season. So yeah, there's a lot of different ways that this could win.
I saw you call out Taylor Swift for being super intelligent on getting everyone to her Instagram page when she accepted her Grammy. Are you driving people on the seed packets at all to any of your online brands, to your content?
I think the idea would be yes, eventually. We don't want to mess with the seed packs too much because that's like, that is the brand.
It's legacy.
It's legacy. It's what people love. The art's beautiful. We're not really doing too much there. That being said, maybe throw a QR code on and it links to a grow guide that we've put together, you know?
Yeah.
So that people can kind of plug into the universe. It won't be like a quick thing, because changing, 650 varieties packets and then getting that actually to penetrate the wholesale market takes some time, but it's something that's on the agenda for sure.
Talk to me about your YouTube channels. I know you remind me of Isaac. You're, talking a little bit about how you've taken channels from zero to growing them pretty quickly over on the Katana market there, although this is a little maybe better for the world.
Sure.
How do you determine when to start a new channel, and what are your first moves on like how to know that it's going to scale or how to get it to scale?
You know, I think like I could talk through the decision to start my second channel ever, which was Epic Homesteading, right? And so Epic Gardening was probably, it was probably close to 1 million subscribers by the time I started Epic Homesteading. The logic was really clear though. If you came to Epic Gardening, you wanted gardening content, right? You wanted to know how to grow plants, how to grow houseplants, vegetables, fruits, whatever. And you didn't necessarily come for me, although some people did. I'm not like, we weren't really not a super personality focused channel. You know me, you like me, but you're not like, you don't know the details of my life, you know? The Homestead channel, I really wanted to run more as a vlog lifestyle channel chronicling me buying this home and building it out into this homestead. So I was like, well, I can't really blend those topics on one channel, so I'll start a second one. Similarly with Jacques on our team, he's one of our creators, our lead sort of garden creator and researcher. To tell Jacques' story, you need a channel for Jacques. Now, Jacques can come and feature on Epic Homesteading and Epic Gardening. He can do a whole educational video in the Epic Gardening style. But if you want to go see what Jacques is doing, you go to Jacques' channel, right? Like specifically Jacques. And so that's sort of the logic. Is there enough of a departure that someone would want only this all the time? Then you make another channel.
Very cool. And then what has been your best strategy to support your organic content with paid stuff?
So, we're still sort of working on that. I mean, what's interesting is if you have a very highly trafficked blog, very highly trafficked Instagram and Facebook, you have a retargeting sort of base that's much higher than the average person. So you kind of have that going for you. Frankly, I'm not an expert in paid at all. We have some folks that we work with that are great, and we just brought someone on full time for it. But the logic is that you should be able to create better performing creative than your competitors, since that's sort of what you came from. Mm-hmm. Now, if that's been the case or not just yet, it's hard to say. You should be able to convert at a higher rate, like choose whatever metric I guess you want, but like your ROAS should on the net be higher, like just theoretically, than a competitor who has no presence. So that's sort of some of the logic, but frankly, the way we do it is I'm sure we could get a lot better.
You mentioned something on Twitter also, because I think one of the things, it's funny, we're going through it at D2C right now. Everyone's trying to figure out how you can integrate more like vertical video, social video into your feeds, and then also how to bring people and have that be top of funnel and have a lot of organic algorithms bring in new people, but then actually moving them through to a sale in this environment of just constant video swiping can be a challenge. So talk about how you've seen it done or have done it with ManyChat.
So yeah, I mean, the tough part is, if you're just a short form creator, unless you came up in the early days of TikTok, like it's hard to build affinity in short form. You forget who people are. You're not as attached as you are to a traditional long form YouTuber. And so that's the first thing to keep in mind, is it's just going to be actually harder. So the thing about, what we've done on Instagram recently with the book launch, with this ManyChat integration you're mentioning, is there's a lot of social capital built up from the years of running the Instagram account, right? And so it's not just that I created a banger piece of short form that happens to pair well with the launch of the book, and then you can send a DM on an automated fashion. It's that there's a lot of social capital built up there, but the functionality of how it works, I learned this from all the bloggers, like all the cooking bloggers and the mommy bloggers, basically, because they all monetize with courses, right, or programs or something like that. And so what they'll do is they'll post a recipe, like a video recipe on, crispy baked potatoes or something like that. And they'll do a short form. And if that short form does well, it gets a lot of reach. And what they'll do is they'll use ManyChat. And if you comment a specific word, let's say crispy or something like that, it will read that and it'll auto send in an Instagram compliant way, I think a button, and that button will be a link to whatever you want. And so usually what they'll do is they'll gate it behind an email. They'll capture the email, then they'll deliver the lead magnet, which might be the crispy potato recipe or a list of recipes. And then now you're on their list and they can then market to you in the way that hopefully they convert you on whatever it is that they're selling, right? And so I was like, oh, that's kind of interesting because it removes like 5 to 7 steps of friction from converting from social, right? Specifically Instagram, because Instagram would be like, read the caption, click on the person's profile, click on their bio, which is a link in bio, scroll around on all those buttons to find the thing, click on that, then type your email in. You know, it's like a lot of different steps. So it just takes it to one step, you know, click on your DM, click that link, then do the next thing. So the friction was a lot lower. It's like, oh, this is interesting. And so I created a video about my 3-year progress of like growing at this house that I have, that I live in. And I had done one the year before, it did well. So I was like, okay, I think this is a piece of content that will do well if I update it. Updated it. And I think on TikTok and Instagram, probably we've sold like 1,000 copies just from that. Just from doing that, which is like the demand was there, but the platforms gate you from servicing the demand because they don't technically really want you to leave, right? Mm. And so it's a compliant way to do it. And on TikTok, it was TikTok Shop that ended up doing that. But either way, like there are ways you can sell on short form that actually work.
Super interesting. One of the themes that's coming up on the podcast a lot these days is, you know, I've been in a Facebook marketing agency for a really long time. Everything, when you have a hammer, everything looks like a nail. I think of the funnel on as like, oh, a Facebook acquisition engine, top, middle, bottom, all happens on Meta. Whereas a lot of brands think about true top of funnel activities. Your whole business is sort of true top of funnel activities. Are mm-hmm. Do you have the formula down now, you think, to sort of grow your top of funnel awareness through your own efforts rather than having to acquire it by buying a Super Bowl ad or, you know, like, do you have other things that you add on to your organic efforts to try to access more top of funnel?
Not really. I mean, I think we're really strong there. And so we frankly are trying to shore up where we're less strong, which would be like the standard commercial functions of a D2C business, like site experience, you know, conversion, merchandising, assortment, paid acquisition, like non-organic channels, all that kind of
retention,
stuff.
Retention, email marketing, all that.
All that stuff is like, we have to learn that at a level that is sometimes surprising for a commerce brand at our scale. Like you typically wouldn't get to our scale and not know some of the things that we're learning as an organization. Then again, there's a strength and a crutch of being able to say like, hey, we just launched a new product to many millions of people for $0. And not only that, you probably get paid for it because you're running, there's ads on those pieces of content, right? So yeah, it's interesting though. The weakness becomes a strength if over-relied on, or sorry, reverse, the strength becomes a weakness.
It definitely sounds like a strength, I bet, to a lot of our listeners. What is the breakdown of revenue roughly of ad revenue to your own products that you sell? I bet it's pretty small ad revenue compared now to what you guys sell.
Yeah. I won't share the exact breakdown, but it suffice to say, like, it is a commerce business now. The ad revenue and the brand and media revenue basically services to operate the team that produces it. And pretty much that's it. There's no, it'll never be an opportunity to make like tens of millions in gardening media, you know? So, nor should there be really. It just doesn't make a lot of sense.
How are you using AI? Are you using AI in the content game? It's something we use on the D2C side a lot.
Sometimes, I mean, generative fill in Photoshop's actually been really nice because we shoot outdoors all the time. So if you're shooting a thumbnail and there's like a little piece of trash in the background or something, it's very easy now to swap that with something else or to add a plant here or there. We don't use it a whole lot. We use it 0% in our writing. We don't use it on the blog at all. In general, I think we use a touch of it in our CX function. So we're on Gorgeous, and so they have a bit of an integration going on there, but we still like heavily adjust the output and add in custom links to our content and all that kind of stuff.
Do you have any D2C hot takes that you're thinking about these days?
Man, one that I think is interesting is this whole UGC idea, because we are, Epic is made up of use, like we're users of the gardening, you know, content that we create. So I never understood this whole UGC thing, because it's not user generated if you pay someone to make it, right? Like, it's not UGC just by default if you commissioned it.
That's funny.
So
I never thought of that.
That never made sense to me, because I was like, that's not UGC. That's just a fake testimonial,
that's
right?
That's pay to play. Yeah, that's...
So I never really got that one. Well, I guess my hot take on D2C is I don't really get why everyone's arguing all the time about it on Twitter. Like, it seems like everyone's arguing about all these different things. I'm like, feels like there's 12 people like debating one another and like clapping each other. I'm like, why not just be friends? Isn't there more to learn from being friends?
I think that's a good take. Why can't we all just be friends? I think people just love everyone's D2C famous or whatever, right? And they know, you're the guy that thinks this, you're the guy that thinks this. And right, people just like these sort of plays back and forth.
You know what? That's my hottest take is, and look, we have quite a few followers on all these different channels. I think I've at this point sort of dissociated from the ego boost of having those, you know what I mean? But I will say it is interesting to see folks in B2B industries get really high on the supply of having like 10,000 followers on Twitter and being like, I'm a big shot now. It's like, okay, no, like none of us are. We're all transient entities on this internet thing. Well, we all sort of go in and out of everyone's consciousness, and you know, you're not a big deal because the number says five figures on your follower count, you know?
Just because you got daddy on the back of your Twitter name. That's D2C daddy to plant
that's
daddy.
That's what does it, you know?
Are you also a daddy as well? Do you have kids?
I don't have kids. No, I don't have kids yet. But when I do, I'm going to have to maybe change my name. We'll see.
No, you don't. I think you'll just grow into it even more.
Yeah.
Nice, Kevin. Thanks for coming on the podcast. I think everyone should follow you on Twitter, because it's like you. It's funny. You got some good takes on there. You've got a good marketing mind, obviously, even though you've come up in this content space, in the green thumb space. So you're always good to follow. Any advice out there for people? Like, if you were doing it all over again, would you do it in the same sort of linear commerce fashion where you create the audience first and launch a product into it?
I mean, I'm good at that, so I probably would do it that way, but I wouldn't say that's a way to do it, you know, like the playbook or whatever. I think the advice I would say is just whatever your craziest strength is, just leverage that to develop all the other things that you need to build the business, you know? So that happened to be mine, but if you were like a product god or something, maybe just do that and partner up with someone like an Isaac from Mini Katana. He's a genius at short form video, actually at many things, but... I'd say go your own path tends to be the advice that makes people win really hard, but it's hard because it's not prescriptive at all. It's just like, hey, go figure it out and, you know, use the head on your shoulders to make good decisions.
Love it. Great advice. Thanks, Kevin. This was a lot of fun.
Yeah. Thanks, man.
Thanks so much for listening to today's episode. If you're not a subscriber to our newsletter, you can do that right now at directtoconsumer.co. I'm Eric Dick, and this has been the D2C Podcast. We'll see you next time.